You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
In October, the International Program on the State of the Ocean, in partnership with the International Union of Conservation of Nature, released its report. Based on an intensive workshop in 2012 with internationally respected scientists and scholars, the report concluded that threats to the ocean are even worse than previously thought. Major stressors such as acidification, ocean warming, and overfishing have accelerated, and few countries get even a passing grade on dealing with these problems. Award-winning scholar and scientist Tony Pitcher is the founding director of the Fisheries Center at the University of British Columbia, where he's a professor. And Tony is one of the contributors to the State of the Ocean 2013 report, and he joins us today. Good morning, Tony, and welcome to Red Eye.
Good morning, Mochai.
Now, this is one of several reports. How did this review come about?
Well, it came about because the State of the Oceans group based in Oxford, England, they gathered about 20 to 25 of us experts from different areas of the ocean science to look at what the future might be. And unfortunately, it doesn't look that great. It was very interesting to meet people from geophysicists, geochemists, and so on, who dealing with other aspects of the ocean, because they're people that in the fisheries world we don't often meet. And we all compared notes, and it was actually a little bit depressing that things are actually worse than people had thought, especially because of the synergies between the different sciences, between the ocean chemistry, for example, and fisheries, and the pollution and fisheries. Lots of interactions that we haven't really realized were happening before. And so that's the focus of the report, as to whether we should be optimistic or pessimistic about the future of our oceans.
You wrote a report or a one of the documents, and you titled it Hope or Despair, sort of a polarity, quite dramatic, with lots of room in between. But what are some of your conclusions from that paper?
The motivation for the fisheries paper was specifically that, among fisheries scientists in the last 5 years or so, there's been a group who've said that things were really bad and getting worse, and we weren't doing much to improve things. And another group who said, well, actually, you know, there are some bright spots, and things are improving, and we are getting fisheries management much better than we used to have it. And so really the fisheries article is to trying to look at which of those two polarities is correct. I'm afraid our conclusion was on the negative side, although, in fact, you know, both groups of scientists are right. There are some bright spots, and or should I say brighter spots. So we try to identify those and see how general they are. Unfortunately, they're not that widespread, but there are some hopeful signs. And so that's what the article is about, in some detail, looking at where these are and why they succeed, and some of the things that are taking us in the opposite direction.
What are especially destructive factors that you found in the fisheries?
I think one of the most disconcerting trends is the failure of management agencies around the world to follow the advice given by the main international United Nations fisheries organization, which is based in Rome in Italy, called the Food and Agriculture Organization, known in the trade as FAO. And in the mid-90s, FAO issued a document called the Code of Conduct for Responsible Fisheries. And actually, Canada can pat itself on the back, because Canada was one of the few countries that initiated that that process, leading to the 1995 publication. So Canada had a major role in that. And from fisheries scientists, that publication is superb. It actually includes everything in a lot of detail that you need to do to manage fisheries responsibly and sustainably. It is really an excellent document. It misses almost nothing. It's very thorough. So the document proves that in the 90s we knew what to do. Unfortunately, the compliance with that code is not very good. It's a voluntary code. It's not a part of international law, which is perhaps an unfortunate thing, but it was adopted as a voluntary code by the UN. And if you look in detail at how nations comply with the various aspects of it, we boiled it down to 42 questions, actually. So if you look at how countries comply with those 42 issues, it's really not very good. Even the best countries don't even get a good mark. They get less than 60%, actually. And something like 30% of countries get less than 40%, a complete fail. So that's rather disconcerting.
Is this the same as the compliance? Is that the same as, I understand there's something called illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing?
Right. Illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing is one of the aspects that the code covers. So it's one of the aspects within that, those 42 questions, I think about four or five questions concern the IUU part of it. And again, worldwide, that's pretty bad. Our estimates from a separate exercise are that something like 35 to 50% of the world's fish catch is actually in that illegal category.
That's again, astounding, given the amount of fish there.
It surprised us, too. And now, in developed countries, like Canada, for example, and Norway, that figure is much lower. Our estimate for the BC coast is about 18%, which is more than you might think, but still much lower than the world average.
How does that work, that people fish illegally? Are these large boats that are completely unregulated?
In Canada, no, but around the world, yes. The Chinese distant water fleet, which goes everywhere around the world and operates in the high seas as well as illegally in some countries, EEZs, that has at least, I think the figure is, and that's not from us, that's from another group that looked at that, about 2 million tons a year of illegal catch. So there are those large vessels. Yeah. So then in other areas, the unreported, in other areas, the IUU catch, that includes unreported as well as illegal. The unreported catch comes from small-scale fisheries that are just not measured and not counted. So they're not illegal, but they're caught by thousands of small-scale fishermen inshore. And that catch is never reported. So we until you estimate it, you didn't know it was being taken from the ocean.
So it can be, I mean, the oceans are huge, and of course these ships travel everywhere, so you can can catch one place, pack it another place, and sell it a third place. And
The fish actually often goes to a third country for processing. Around the world, all sorts of fish is actually now sent to China for processing. The most amazing example I came across was small prawns being caught off the west coast of Scotland, being shipped to China to be processed and then shipped back to Scotland to be sold. That's one of the issues, really, is the source of these seafood commodities that is often a bit difficult to find where they've come from. In theory, most fish coming into developed countries has got to have what's called a chain of custody document, which says that, you know, where it's come from and who's had it until it gets to the market. Unfortunately, those documents are sometimes a little bit suspect as to what's been filled in on the document. So that's where most of the illegal fish. I think the fish coming into the U.S., people have estimated, is something like 25% of it is actually from illegal and unreported sources.
With this complex chain of origin, can you make any assessments as to which countries are better at managing their fisheries and oceans?
Right. The country that comes top around the world is Norway. They have quite good control and very high compliance with the regulations by Norwegian fishers. And one of the things that they do that we don't do is that they ban all discards of fish from the vessels. And here, actually, and in the U.S., we actually encourage discards, because the way that the quotas work is that if you catch a fish you don't have a quota for, you have to throw it back into the ocean, which is a bit of a waste. And that is banned in Norway and Iceland, and I think one or two other countries now around the world. So Norway gets high scores for things like that, in very careful regulations that that don't cause wastage of food taken from the ocean.
Is there just a direct correlation between wealthier countries and more compliance with...
Yes, it correlates quite well with a number of indices, of, like, for example, the GDP per capita of the nation. It also, the amount of compliance with the code correlates quite well with the Human Development Index, which is a UN index looking at the welfare, the general status of welfare in a country. It's not just economics, but it's other indicators of the conflict in society and the quality of the political governance and things like that. And so we looked at the correlations with these various international indices, and yes, there is a strong correlation with developed countries. There are some outliers. Some third world countries actually do surprisingly well for their status. One of those is Namibia, which actually scores quite well for its level of development in terms of quality of fisheries management. And it's interesting that since independence, Namibia has had its fishery system set up and organized by our friends in Norway. So that's one reason why it works quite well. And amongst the developed nations, there are a number of unfortunate circumstances where, unfortunate countries where they do quite a lot worse than you would expect from their development status. And those include a lot of European countries that, as part of the common fisheries policy, which until recently has been a bit of a disaster, those do rather worse in terms of the quality of their fisheries management, measured as compliance with the code.
I want to ask you as well, you work with this international program on the state of the ocean.
Right.
What were the main recommendations that you made that would improve the fisheries?
Right. Well, I think our main recommendation from the fisheries part of it was to try and get the voluntary code of conduct for responsible fisheries adopted as international law by the UN itself. And that's beginning to happen. Some elements of the code have been adopted by the main UN General Assembly and now have the status of international law. Unfortunately, the whole code has not been taken in that way, and I think that would be a major step towards improving things if that were to happen.
Is Canada complying?
Yes. I think it came... let me think now. I think it was in the top five or six. It wasn't as high as you might have hoped. But and as I say, it got way less than 60% for its score of compliance. So it has a number of areas where it's not doing as well as you would hope for its development status. Because Canada's internationally is doing pretty well. And it's a nice country to live in. has a good HDI and all those kind of things. So, yeah, but you would expect it to do better than it does. And it's actually got a little bit worse recently as well.
Thank you very much for joining us, Tony.
Thank you, Mordecai.
I've been speaking with Tony Pitcher. He's professor of fisheries at the University of British Columbia and one of the contributors to the State of the Ocean 2013 report. You can find the report and other information on the international program on the State of the Ocean at stateoftheocean.org.